Hello, listeners, and welcome back to another edition of the Bills on the Border podcast. Hope you all had a wonderful 4th of July weekend. It is Monday, July 6th, and I'm joined in the dining room with my roommate and dear friend, Mr. Tommy Watson. Tommy, how was your 4th of July?
It's pretty good. Got to see some good fireworks, some cool stuff, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a great weekend out at Lake Viking. I went out there with a friend and his family who I go to the lake with on major extended holiday weekends, and it was a great time. We got to jet ski and chill out on the boat, go to Party Cove and meet some new people and eat a lot of great food. And
yeah, I heard you had some good food.
Yeah, yeah. Some smoked ribs, some, buffalo chicken mac and cheese, which was excellent. Lots of good beer, good drinks, banana daiquiris, some rum drinks with pineapple juice. I mean, it was like living in paradise for the last 3 days. So it was great. And then, came back yesterday and got to enjoy the Women's World Cup final, which is going to be the first thing we're talking about today. The women's national team brought on the World Cup title, defeating Japan pretty handedly.
The game was basically never in doubt for the U.S.
Yeah. I mean, the first goal coming, essentially in the first minute of play, Carly Lloyd, oh my gosh. Performance of a lifetime. 3 goals in 16 minutes. Completed a hat trick in the first 16 minutes of the first half. And what was so impressive were the first 2 goals that the United States scored were coming off set pieces. The first one coming off Megan Rapinoe's corner to Carly Lloyd. And I think when you see them score off these set pieces, a lot of credit has to be given to Jill Ellis, the head coach of the women's team. I mean, she really identified the Japanese's difficulty in set piece defending, throughout the tournament, and it opened up to a quick 2-goal lead essentially in the first 5 minutes of play. And you have to give credit to her as well, because this team struggled in group play. I mean, they didn't lose in group play, but they certainly struggled in some of those games against lesser opponents. But they got better as the tournament went on. I mean, really, the theory in these World Cup tournaments is survive in advance, get out of group play, then you continue, and that's when you build. And that's exactly what this team did. And I think it really speaks to how this team, I mean, this team didn't even really look great against Colombia in that first game out of group play. But they looked amazing in their game against Germany, and they looked otherworldly in the game yesterday against Japan. And those were the 2 best matches of the tournament. And that's what you want. You want to be continuously building each match, each game, to play better. And they really delivered. Jill Ellis had a lot of tough decisions to make. I mean, she benched Abby Wambach after group play to kind of get a more agile, quick, team. And it worked. She started Megan Bryan after group play. And these decisions that she had to make really had a positive impact on this team. And it's hard to take a veteran like Abby Wambach out that late into a tournament like the World Cup and continue to perform. And then, again, enough can't be said about Carly Lloyd's performance. Hat trick in the first 16 minutes of the game. That bomb shot from the halfway line is one of the coolest goals I've seen men, women's, any World Cup match, let alone – or soccer match. I mean, that was just amazing. I mean, what were your thoughts watching the game?
Well, that goal in particular was real impressive. I felt like it was a little more kind of on the Japanese goalie because she got caught napping. She got caught too far out.
Yeah, exactly.
But it was impressive to see Carly take advantage of that and just
recognize the opportunity.
Chip shot it in
there. Put it on point. And that was really impressive. And now, Carly Lloyd has kind of always been this player that we talk about. You see she just comes up so – she's like frustratingly clutch. And she really delivered. I mean – in the game against Germany, she delivered that great pass to Kelly O'Hara to clinch that game against Japan in the semifinal. And at 32 years old, she's now a golden ball winner and a World Cup champion. I mean, I think that in itself is a huge accomplishment for her career. And not just Carly Lloyd, there were players on this women's team who stepped up across the board. Especially, you look at somebody like Alex Morgan, who she was the lone striker in most of these matches, and she had to step up and play with a lot more grit and physicality than we're used to her playing with, because she's this speed, quick, agile forward who had to really play a physical game, and she was jumping in there for headers and playing a tough game, you know, up in the box. Those are a lot of things we're accustomed to see Abby Wambach doing. Well, Alex Morgan was doing that in a lot of these matches later on. And, you know, it wasn't just Alex Morgan either. It was, you know, Becky Sauerbrunn, who she really led the back line of defense with her exceptional play. And it wasn't even clear if she was going to be the one that was starting back there. But this 30-year-old St. Louis native came up, and there were some, you know, some whispers of her maybe being in contention to win the golden ball of the tournament because of how important she was to that back line defense for the United States. And then, you know, you got super subs coming in like Kelly O'Hara. She didn't see any action in group play or against Colombia, and then comes in to start the quarterfinal match and then have the game-clinching goal, like we mentioned earlier, off that great pass by Carly Lloyd in the game against Germany. I mean, it was just an impressive, incredible performance by everybody on that team, from the manager down to, you know, the subs that didn't even get to see action. And then the person you have to give, I think, the most amount of props to because of the role she accepted was Abby Wambach. I mean, she is the face of United States soccer. She is the all-time leading goal scorer, and she just has been the face of this team. To accept a relegation in many ways to a bench role because it was so crucial to this team being able to play the style that they needed to play, props to her for accepting that diminished role. And it was a really great moment, too, after the World Cup final was over, especially considering everything that's gone on, you know, with the Supreme Court ruling a couple weeks ago, for her to have that embrace with her girlfriend, that kiss on national television. I think a lot of people were really excited to see that. So, again, props to Abby Wambach. Props to this entire team for really making, you know, for being the center of the country's attention this weekend and for the last couple of weeks with their incredible play and really representing the United States. And when you think about it, the United States is kind of the center of the soccer world right now. I think, you know, when you consider all the external factors, the men's team has just beaten the number one and number six team in the country in the last month. The women's team has just won the Women's World Cup, and the FBI is hopefully going to put away the corrupt FIFA president and his, you know, cohorts that were involved in that whole corruption of FIFA. So it's nice to have the United States at the center of the soccer world right now.
Yeah, I really like where we've come in terms of just the nation as a whole and recognizing soccer, because I feel like maybe not even 10 years ago, people would just treated soccer like it was a sport that didn't apply to us. It's the world sport. I know it's still not as popular here, but I feel like it was very kind of ignorant of people to just ignore it and pretend like it wasn't a big deal. And right. I like how a lot more people are embracing it. Mm-hmm. And the fact that, well, the women's team has basically always been good, but how the men's team is improving. And I think within the next several World Cups for the men, we'll start to see a more competitive team as the generations, like our generation that grew up playing soccer, not necessarily baseball and stuff, as we start to come into the pro levels and improve the overall talent.
So hopefully someday our men's team is as stacked with talent as our you know, women's national team is. But it was an awesome tournament to watch. You know, they like I said, they got better as the tournament progressed, and it's just fun to watch. And I'm really, you know, they made us proud as Americans to go out there and watch them, you know, win.
Yeah, and you know, actually, it felt really awesome being in Kansas City for this World Cup too, because I think for most of the games, Kansas City actually led the country in viewership.
Yeah, and it's just a cool thing, and I wish these tournaments happened more often it's just such a fun atmosphere. You know, to go down to Power and Light and watch those games with the big crowds of people who are just as emotionally invested as you are. And I don't think I can talk about enough how cool of a moment it was yesterday for that team to win, and to win in such a commanding fashion and avenge that 2011 loss at the hands of the Japanese. So moving on, we go ahead and talk about the Royals. A little bit talked about today. The most recent news is that the Royals will be sending down right-hand reliever Jason Frazier to bring up Paul Orlando. And then we have placed Mike Moustakas on the 3 to 7 day bereavement leave, which is the second time this year that he has been placed on bereavement leave, and we've called up infielder Chelsea Cuthbert from AAA to replace him for those days. He's said tend to a family emergency. So prayers obviously out to Mike Moustakas and his family, because there's clearly been some things going on personally for him this year, and he's been playing so well, and he's such an integral part of this team. We wish him all the best. But back to Jason Frazier, this is hard, for a lot of Royals fans who have grown to really like Jason Frazier, because he was such an important part of our playoff run last year. He was really solid out of that bullpen during that playoff run. Have not seen him a lot this year. His ERA is a little deceiving. He's got a 1.5 ERA in 26 appearances or 26 games that he's appeared in this year. But he's got an alarmingly high walk rate, and he hasn't appeared since June 29th. Or has only pitched once, since June 29th. So we had to determine which guy was expendable in this call, because we've got guys that are hurt right now. Kane's nursing some injuries. Our outfielders are playing every single day. So now Jason Frazier can – the Royals are responsible for the remainder of his deal unless he's claimed off of waivers or we trade him in the next 10 days. And if that doesn't happen, we can assign him to the minors, although he can refuse assignment. And it's likely that somebody who is contending this year that needs some bullpen help will claim him off of waivers. So are you sad to see Jason Frazier go?
I am. I mean, he's been kind of one of our go-to relievers when, we're looking at someone at our three top relievers.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of sad to see him go. And I also, because I feel like he will not – I don't think he's going to clear waivers. I think he's going to end up with another team.
Yeah, and I think he's going to may end up with another team like the Tigers, who could use some relief help, and we'd have to face him potentially in some pretty crucial games down the stretch of the season. What really hit home for me, what made me sad, is that in his interview when he was talked about it, he said it's always, you're never really ready for that call. He knew that it was possibly in the cards that this would happen, but he gets the call from Dayton Moore. He gets interviewed, following the announcement, and he said, if my wife was here, I'd say it was the greatest 3 months of my career, but because she's not, I'm going to go ahead and say it was the best 3 months of my life. And in those three months that he was with the Royals last year after he was picked up from the Texas Rangers. So when someone cares about, being a part of this organization, a part of this franchise as much as he does, it's hard to see him go. And it's hard to think that he might be, going up against, our team, later on in July and August, when he was so instrumental in that great playoff run last year. So we obviously wish Jason Frazier the best if he does end up with another club. And it's just tough because it really just comes down to a numbers thing and who's the most expendable. And right now it's Frazier, but I guess that's the business. I mean, baseball's a business. And that's something that people have to accept. So that's the news of today. Not a great week for the Royals since we last were talking about them. They were coming off that great sweep of the A's over the week and the last time we were on. This week, though, they got swept by the Astros, who now some may argue are the best team in the American League. Royals have a better winning percentage, but the Astros have more wins. And then we split the four-game set against the Twins. The sweep in Houston was disappointing, but it's not surprising. And you've kind of alluded to this before, because of the way their ballpark is set up and the type of starting pitching we have.
Yeah, I didn't think it was that big of a deal. In terms of going... two and five for a week. Yeah. It actually does not seem that bad because we split with Minnesota, the second place team in the Central, so no ground lost there.
Right.
And then playing in Houston, it's kind of a small ballpark. They have some good home run hitters.
Right.
And we are playing with a real janky lineup. We had some injuries. We didn't ever have anything right for us. It would have been nice to get at least one win out of that, but I was not surprised to see us get swept.
And we're not playing with a strong rotation in terms of a small ballpark.
No, no.
And there's even rumors that the fences in Houston's ballpark are even shorter than they claim them to be. That center field wall is just a little over 320 feet. So when you're dealing with that, it becomes difficult to keep a lot of those balls in play, especially when you've got guys like Edison Volquez and Joan Blanton, who aren't really known as players who get a lot of strikeouts, but they're guys who will get balls in play. But, in, say, Kauffman, a lot of those home runs don't leave the ballpark. A lot of people started to panic. The conversation drove to what is Ned doing in these games? He's not making the right decisions. This is what happens when you have bad streaks during a baseball season. But the reality is, it's a 162 game season. There are going to be weeks where you go 2-5, and I think the average fan needs to understand There will inevitably be rough patches during a 162-game season. When we win the first seven games of the year, well, there are going to be points where we lose five straight or lose four straight. Now, obviously, you don't hope those things to happen, but in a 162-game season, those will inevitably happen. And we also have to keep in mind that we have a 4.5-game lead now over the Twins, still.
Yeah.
After going 2-5 last week.
That's the most important part.
Yeah, and we're 13 games above 500, which I don't know that we've ever seen this team be that far above 500 this late in the season. And if we did, it was probably in 2003. I'd have to go back and check the numbers. But we ended the week on a positive note. We won in walk-off fashion. Two of my favorite players were involved in the final play. Eric Hosmer driving in Lorenzo Cain from first base on a double.
That was very impressive.
It was awesome. I mean, and Cain, who's nursing a sore hamstring, was on his horse. And it was not a bang-bang place, but the plate, I mean, the throw could have made it there, you know, if he hadn't been on his horse.
It was a little offline, but, he got there plenty of time, it seemed to me.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you watch that game when it happens on Sunday. Obviously, a great way to cap off the week. I think the fan base as a whole just needs to take a collective deep breath and realize that there will be weeks of subpar baseball for this club. And it's kind of like Game of Thrones. It's not going to be great every single week. You have to kind of take your lumps and your bruises and have those episodes where Stannis burns Shireen at the stake, okay? You're going to have ups and downs and highs and lows. But then you're going to have weeks where it's like the Battle of Hardhome, and we win every game in a week. You know, so that's kind of what I want people to realize. When you play an excellent style of baseball or an excellent style of any sport, sometimes it just doesn't work. Sometimes your throws are a little short. Sometimes you're behind a little bit on your swing. Sometimes your reaction time is not there. Sometimes a play where you normally beat out the throw, you don't beat out the throw to beat out the throw when you're trying to steal. I mean, you just have to consider that there are going to be ups and there's going to be downs. The goal is to just have more ups than there are downs.
Yeah.
It's kind of life. You just want to have more ups than there are downs. It's inevitable. But, you know, going into this week, this is the last week before the All-Star break. We're going to complete the first half of the season with a four-game set against the Rays and a three-game set against the Blue Jays, both of whom are in competition for the AL East. So these are teams that want to win right now. And so how crucial it is to win these games and carry momentum into the All-Star break.
I think we need to win. We need to win probably at least three times this week. I think the All-Star break, though, is coming at a perfect time for us.
Yes.
We're a little banged up, not too bad, but it'll give us some rest. And for like the fans, it'll give us a chance to enjoy the amount of All-Stars we're going to have, which we'll talk about here in a sec.
Yeah.
And it'll just give everyone a chance to kind of take a breath, look at the bigger picture about how the Royals are ideally going to have still a 4-5 game lead in the division.
Yeah.
And everyone will just realize that it's fine.
It's fine, yeah. And we can kind of start the second season with a fresh note. I mean, I agree with you. I think it'll be crucial for us to win at least three games so that while we might be literally limping into the All-Star break with some of our injuries, we won't figuratively be limping into the All-Star break as a club. So going like you said, we're talking about the All-Stars. It's not 8 All-Stars like the fan vote had indicated earlier in the process, but it's a pretty good number. We got 4.
4 starters, 2 reserves for sure.
Yeah.
And Moose is on the final vote for the reserve. So we could potentially have 7 All-Stars, which
right.
I bet is probably the 6 we have now is probably the most we've ever had. So
yeah, and you know, so we got Cain, who will probably start in right, I'd have to imagine, because
yeah.
He can play right or center, and Trout's pretty much solely a center fielder. Gordon will start in left field. Escobar will start at short. And then Perez will start at catcher. And you can argue that, you know, if you look at them from not just an offensive but a defensive standpoint, these are pretty clear-cut choices. You can argue maybe with the decision to have, you know, Gordon in there. But in terms of a wins above replacement, Cain is one of the best players in the majors for wins above replacement, and Alex Gordon has probably been the best outfielder defensively in the majors this year, and his offense has come alive at certain points in the season. Escobar has had an outstanding year, and it's probably about time he's due for an All-Star nod because of how well he plays. And Perez, you know, he wasn't the leading vote-getter overall, but he was one of the leading vote-getters in the American League. He's obviously one of the most popular players in baseball. I think there's no denying that. Fans across country love him because of his Instagrams with Lorenzo Cain, because of his kind of goofy, outward nature. There's no reason to dislike Salvador Perez. And so it's hard to argue them deserving to be there. And you could potentially make a case for Moose over Donaldson. because but Donaldson's having a great year, but so is Moose. So that's why I'm excited to see him get in on that fan vote. Cabrera will be on the disabled list for the All-Star game. Does this mean that maybe Hosmer gets an opportunity, or what have you been hearing on that?
I don't think Hosmer would, because I think he would have to have been listed as one of the reserves today to be okay. The potential starter.
And the reserves, I believe, there was potential for Pujols or Teixeira to
be. Yeah, they're both on the roster.
They're both on the roster. So I would venture to guess Ned avoids ruffling any feathers, because Ned can name All-Star players to the roster that weren't voted in. But I don't think he does that just because I think he's not going to use one of his manager selections for Hosmer. Hosmer will be there at some point in his career. Just unfortunately this year it wasn't in the cards. So enough about the All-Star game, because we've kind of talked about it a lot. But I kind of want to talk about looking after the All-Star game. What this team needs to do moving forward to really push into the postseason in the second half. Because this team is poised to make a deep run. This team is poised to make the playoffs, to win the division, and win the pennant. But I think that shouldn't be the goal. The goal should be to win the whole shebang and get back to the World Series. Do you think this team needs to make a trade sometime after the break to push them over that edge, to get to that next level?
I think they will need to do something. I feel like they have several capable starters. I know we've gotten in our arguments about the Young, the Guthrie, the Vargas, and
right.
Blanton, not so much now, but I still think they need another starter. They need someone who's just consistent. Cause yeah. It's just painful that Volquez is basically our only consistent starter. Mm-hmm. Duffy's had a couple good starts.
He's had some good starts recently. Right.
Ventura's been down doing rehab starts, so we don't know what he's going to be like when he comes back. But then Young has had more ups and downs his last couple starts.
Right.
Guthrie had a fantastic start the other day,
mm-hmm.
but
didn't get him the run support to get the victory. Or was that against the Twins?
I think that was against the Twins. Was Friday night's game. I think we won that in extras, but he didn't pick up the W on that. But I mean, just the way that kind of the back end of the rotation has just been so up and down. We need someone else consistent. Yeah.
Inconsistent is a nice way of putting it.
Yeah.
Like I said, I don't think we can realistically expect the trio of Young, Guthrie, and Blanton to be a long-term, let alone a short-term solution. And I think what makes most sense is to go target those pitchers on the clubs like Oakland or Cincinnati, where Scott Kazmir or Johnny Cueto might be available. And, I am just foaming at the mouth of the notion of Cueto towing the mound in a Royals uniform. One, because I freaking love his hair, and I think he would look badass in a Royals jersey. And two, he's a solid starter, and he could realistically be that ace this ball club needs. I know Ventura has been pegged as that guy, but Cueto can come in and be a guy who, for a short term, potentially even a long term, if he's interested in re-signing after his deal's up that we trade, if we were to trade for him, really being a veteran guy for this club. Obviously there will be some more things getting in the mix because Vargas, Ventura, and Medlin are all set to come off the DL sometime after the All-Star break. But I think Johnny Cueto would give that rotation the makeup of a world champion world rotation. Think about a rotation of Volquez, Ventura, a stable Danny Duffy if he can recalibrate and stay on this, this course that he's on and getting more innings and be more consistent. Young and Cueto would arguably be one of the best, rotations in the American League just based off of the perceived level of talent and what you can get out of those guys. And then having Vargas, Guthrie, and Medlin as an off-day starter or insurance if one of those guys goes down, I think that would make the most sense. Or if you throw Kazmir there, you throw another lefty into that rotation. What are your thoughts?
I have such mixed feelings about this idea because I think for the most part in our lifetime, the Royals have really never been buyers at the trade deadline. They've either sat and done nothing or they've sold. But, I mean, there's potential for these plans to work. I want Cueto because I really like his talent. But there's something to be said for how he's potentially a rental player and he could only be here for about half a season.
Right.
And we're going to have to give up some good players, probably one of our top prospects to get him.
Right. And we don't want to do what the Oakland A's did last year, where they essentially mortgaged their future to maybe compete for a pennant.
I think their mistake last year is they already had good pitching. They got greedy with it, right, and they traded their best offensive player
for Lester, who you knew was not going to stick around after his deal expired.
Yeah.
And then you trade for Samardzija, who bolts for the White Sox. So you basically mortgage your future for a potential run. But when you think about it, and I don't want to sound skeptical, but the Royals' window is not as large as some people might think it is.
No, it's not.
It's closing in pretty rapidly because we actually have the second oldest club in the majors behind the New York Yankees. Our average age of our players is 29. Now, getting Frazier out the door certainly is going to help with that age, but you have to consider our young talent is due for a payday soon. And
yeah,
some of these guys won't be here and some of these guys will. So you kind of have to take the good with the bad and really kind of weigh what your options are. And I'm interested to see what Dayton Moore and the rest of the organization decides to do as we move towards that trade deadline here in a few weeks. So enough about the Royals because we've spent a considerable amount of time talking about them now so far. Want to talk about True Detective, our favorite show on television right now. Maybe we'll talk about, is it staying our favorite show on television? We watched the third episode last night, Night Finds You. And we left off last episode with kind of a cliffhanger. The masked bird man inside of Ben Casper's second home shoots and maybe kills Ray Velcoro. We had our own theories, and I can kind of agreed that in order for his show to survive, the character of Ray Velcoro had to survive as well. So the episode opens kind of oddly with a dream sequence with a Conway Twitty impersonator on stage at the bar we've frequently seen Ray at, and Conway Twitty is singing Bette Midler's The Rose. So the episode is already off to a very strange start. But as in most True Detective fashion, I was on board with it because I put a lot of faith in Nick Pizzolatto and what he does with these stories. And this season's obviously different from last, and I think we'll touch on that in a minute. But he's having an odd conversation with his father, who's in a police uniform. And he talks about his father's talking to Ray about a dream he had. An odd dream, but essentially he's saying that Ray is killed in this dream, right? And he's getting chased by, I don't know, monkeys, something weird.
Yeah, it was weird.
It was very weird. But the dream sequence ends, and we realize that Ray's alive. And
yep,
we realize that it is kind of what we predicted it would be last week, and that it was non-lethal rounds. It was essentially a salt rock
kind of riot control type stuff.
Yeah, riot control type stuff. And I think for everyone who feels like Ray Velcoro not dying was cheap or contrived in some way, let's remember that last season, Russ Cole was pretty badly stabbed, almost to the point that he bled out, by the eventual killer in that show, Errol Childress, the guy with the green ears, then the spaghetti monster and the cut-up face. And Errol Childress also took an axe to the center of Marty's chest.
Yeah.
And they both lived at the end. So I think to say that it was some cheap trick by Pizzolatto or contrived or just pandering to what people want to see, this has happened before on not just other television shows, but specifically on True Detective. Now, it didn't happen this early on, but it happened nonetheless. I think you and I would be in agreement that Ray cannot be dead.
No.
Because of how essential his character is, not only to the story, but maintaining the watchability of this show so far.
I think they were kind of setting him up at first to make it believable that he was actually
right.
dead.
That he's expensive.
He seemed very hopeless in the first two episodes.
Mm-hmm.
But now he seems a little more
he's
motivated.
He's
angry. He has a meeting with Vince Vaughn's character and he doesn't drink.
Yeah.
Surprisingly.
And he said, and Vince Vaughn says, "Why aren't you drinking?" And he goes, "Drinking takes the edge off, and I want to stay angry."
Yeah, and I really like this aspect of him still being alive too, because now you're kind of wondering, like, was it really, the murderer who shot him, maybe didn't want to kill him,
right,
was trying to set aside, or maybe it was a setup, which is what he's kind of thinking.
Right, and to send a message.
Yeah.
And so here's my theory. I think, one, the person who was behind the shooting knows Ray Velcoro, and Ray Velcoro knows the person who shot him. Ray might not know who that is, but if the person wanted him dead, Ray would be dead right now.
Oh, yes, definitely.
So my theory is that someone on that we've seen on screen was the one that shot Ray. I've heard some conflicting theories that it was the scarred-faced woman in the bar that we've seen Ray interact with a couple times. Obviously, I think the prevailing theory for both you and I is that somebody within maybe Frank Semyon's crew did it to send a message because of the way that Ray was talking with Frank at the end of episode 2. I've also heard some people suggest that maybe it was Annie Bezerides. Maybe she's somehow connected with it because we've seen her sister connected with some sort of online video voyeurism, you know, sexual fetish thing. Maybe there's more to Annie's character that we haven't seen yet, because there really hasn't been a lot of character development for her since episode 1. We've seen that kind of interaction with the, you know, booty call guy she has on the side, which we saw a little more of in episode 3. Mm-hmm. We don't really know a lot about Annie yet. But I think to go back to Ray Velcoro, the character's importance to the show, is a lot of the show has been just average or okay to some degree so far, but the performance by Farrell has made Ray's story arc super intriguing. The relationship with his ex-wife, the relationship with his potential illegitimate son, the relationship between him and Annie Bezerides, because she obviously knows that he's a dirty cop and he knows that she knows. So his story is so central to everything that's happening that we knew he wasn't going to be dead. But it's become abundantly clear through these first 3 episodes that this is a very different type of True Detective that we're used to. Because last season was essentially trusting a narrative that was told from the perspective of 2 storytellers, that being Marty and Rust Cole. Yeah. This year there are 4 central characters, and no one's really telling a story from a perspective. But you know, another character you have to consider is really the location of the city of Vinci and Los Angeles, and you kind of feel this soulless, almost dead vibe from the show and the city and what we've been watching so far. And it's not the same as the deep southern part of Louisiana, but it's got its own identity, just in the same way the setting of season 1 played. And I think once you accept that the show is inherently different, it makes it a lot more enjoyable. Because it's like comparing apples to oranges, because the portrayal of Russ and Marty by McConaughey and Harrelson, respectively, was one of the best on-screen dynamics we've seen in a television show in a long time. Those were 2 very strong characters that drove essentially all the action of the show.
Yep.
Now you're trying to get used to 4 characters with very separate subplots that eventually interconnect, trying to make the show work now. And I think once you see those lines starting to cross and connect, which they are inevitably going to do, I think you'll have a much better product in your hands. It's just a matter of waiting for that to happen. But I think you're continuing to see a strained, almost forced performance from Vince Vaughn at times. What have your thoughts of his performance been so far?
You know, I actually haven't had a big problem with that, but I feel like I'm not a good judge of that. Because I think I wanted to see him as a character, so I may be forcing myself in my mind to accept him. But I know I'm sure there are some people out there who don't see him as this character who just don't like it at all.
I think that there's you're seeing 2 things. You're seeing a part of Ray Velcoro that was written very well for Colin Farrell specifically. And I think a lot of the fault in the performance of Vince Vaughn's character right now is the writing, because he's going very outside of what's in his wheelhouse. Because you see him trying to portray this angry, self-doubting mobster. And in roles that we've seen Vaughn before, we've seen an anger, but not an anger of like a fury. It's almost like a manic anger type. And we've never seen a Vince Vaughn character that has so much self-doubt. When you think of Vince Vaughn, you think of his character in Swingers, Old School, 40-Year-Old Virgin, Wedding Crashers, who are some of the most confident characters ever. And I'm not saying that he's so limited that he has to play those roles, but that's not really the kind of character he can play, as this unconfident. You know, when he asks his lackey, "Am I diminished?" That's not something you're used to seeing from a Vince Vaughn character, which is I don't think it's the fault of the performance. I think a lot of it's the fault of the writing.
Yeah. And actually, it's kind of interesting. In all of the characters he's played, I just kind of thinking, I think the closest he's ever come to playing this type of character was way back in a role that some people barely remember him for, when he played Jamie O'Hara and Rudy.
Right.
Because he was kind of the real angry former top high school type prospect guy
who came crashing back down to earth.
Yeah.
I think the progression we've seen, in, especially in episode 3, gave a little bit more validation to the scene about the watermarks and him being locked in the basement, because we've seen now that he is going to do whatever it takes to stabilize his legitimacy from a financial standpoint and from a legacy standpoint. I've enjoyed the character progression a lot, but I think there are some things that are a little all over the map, but I think those are there for a reason. I think there's going to be more to come out about his wife. I think she's not all she's cracked up to be. I think we kind of saw that in the change from her telling him to suck his own dick in the one scene we saw with her at the beginning, and then from her all apologetic nature at the end. It's clear she wants something from Frank, or is still trying to derive something from him. So I don't fully trust her character yet, and she's given me no reason to do so. But I'm interested to see how much further he's willing to go in terms of being dirty and taking on more of this mobster mentality to get back his $7 million. Because I think it's safe to assume that Ben Casper probably spent a lot of that money.
Yeah.
But were you going to say?
Well, I was going to say, I did really enjoy the scene where Vince Vaughn calls together the meeting of kind of mobsters, and the one guy starts telling him off.
Dan Castro.
He starts you start getting this vibe that, like,
he doesn't control things anymore.
Yeah, and Vince Vaughn's character isn't going to do anything. But then the way he, you know, puts that guy in his place. I mean, at first I thought he was just going to straight up kill him.
Right.
Just pull out a gun and shoot him.
He's got the balls to tell him, you can leave your rings on. Because he knows it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And then he
promptly kicks his ass and pulls out his teeth.
Yeah. So, kind of getting back to the characters we haven't seen a whole lot from. I said earlier, we haven't seen a lot from Annie. We've kind of understood her background, and we're seeing a rapport starting to develop between her and Ray, and her and Paul, Taylor Kitsch's character. And those are the two relationships that I've really found the most interesting this season, aside from Frank and Ray's relationship. But I really would like to see more of them, because I feel like both Annie and Paul have a lot to offer in terms of their story, but we haven't seen a whole lot of it yet.
Mm-hmm.
But we've got a little more exposure to Paul's character, portrayed by Taylor Kitsch. And we learned that a little more in the Middle East happened than just killing a few people. It's obvious now that he had a relationship with another soldier in his unit. And the writing was kind of on the wall leading up to that reveal, because we touched on it last week. We touched that he might be repressing his homosexuality.
Mm-hmm.
How did you interpret that scene, and how do you think that's going to progress with that character going on for the season?
Well, I feel weird. I still am not sure how that's going to play into this.
Mm-hmm.
My takeaway from that scene was the fact that at the very end you see that Ray's partner, who I think is kind of a guy just flying under the radar right now, because,
mm-hmm.
you know, he's been in the meetings they've been having about their investigation, but
right.
he hasn't really done a whole lot. But he was watching them and
right.
taking pictures, so
it'll be
interesting to see how that plays out.
And it also raises the question of who's been feeding this information to the state investigator about what Ray's been doing. Ray's obviously spent a lot of time with his partner. Perhaps he's been just asked to get information on not just Ray, but maybe Paul as well, because Paul's also being investigated for maybe apparently receiving sexual favors to let an actress off the hook, which I think it's safe to assume that he didn't.
Yeah,
but
I think
people are probably doing their due diligence to find out whether or not he did.
Yeah, I agree. I think he did. Nah, sorry.
Yeah, and I think every episode has been slightly better than the next. I think 3, I mean, with all of its flaws, has been the best episode thus far. And so I'm excited for episode 4. I think we'll start to see more subplots come to the surface. You know, seeing the mayor and his family dynamic was really interesting this week. I think that I would love to see a lot more of them, because that was one of those entertaining scenes. It was very weird, but very entertaining
scene. His son was quite the character.
Yeah, his son was quite the character.
Literally.
Yeah. But specifically as it pertains to Ray, with that state investigation into his activities and whether or not Annie decides to stay quiet on what she knows about Ray, because I think she realizes that deep down he's just trying to do his best to keep things together. And it seems like she has a sort of sympathy for him. So I'm interested to see where that goes, because literally one of the last things we heard this week is him basically begging her not to, you know, report what she has on him to the state investigators.
Yeah, I was going to say, my first impression from that very, I think that was the last scene, was I think she may try and help him out.
Yeah.
to a certain degree. I don't think she would totally compromise who she is as a very straight-laced cop.
But she might try and set him on the straight and narrow. And,
yeah, maybe
and
help him avoid future problems.
Right. So we'll move away from True Detective now and get into our last...
Actually, real quick, can I say one more thing about any of the HBO shows? So if any of you are still watching the show Ballers... I just would like you to keep an eye out for an Eric Cosmer cameo in this most recent episode.
In episode 3?
He is an attendant of the party, the big party they have. So if you watch the show, just keep an eye out for
him. I'll have to check that out. I didn't know that. I'm definitely going to watch episode 3 now. I was kind of on the fence about that and Brink. But I've heard the Brink has gotten better, although I'm not quite sure. So I'm going to have to watch those later tonight. We're going to move into my favorite topic. This is my this is my favorite time of the year to talk about NBA basketball, because this is where the whole landscape of the following season kind of takes shape, and we get to learn kind of where guys are going to be, who's going to be, who do you think the team, the power team in each conference will be, who are the big movers and shakers, and there have been a lot of movers and shakers since free agency began, so we're going to just kind of get on to those, and we'll move on to the biggest ones. We'll talk about kind of winners and losers.
So... Tommy, who do you think was maybe the biggest winner in this?
Well, I think the biggest winner, I mean, without question, were the Spurs. And, you know, one, today we found out that they were able to sign David West to a two-year, essentially a mid-level exception contract, so his salary won't be eating too much, and there's already an exception in the salary cap for signing a player like him. So he's going to be a huge addition coming off the bench. But they got the biggest name in free agency. You know, the biggest name in free agency was LeBron James, but it's clear that he's going to sign with the Cavaliers.
The biggest realistic mover.
Biggest fish you could land was LaMarcus Aldridge. The writing was on the wall because we saw Tiago Splitter was traded to create the necessary salary space and create less of a logjam in their backcourt. It gives the Spurs... I think the best shot to win the West next year, aside from the Golden State Warriors, and then the Thunder is obviously in that conversation as well. They're going to be the best team. They were also able to sign Danny Green for less than he was worth, considering how expensive guys who can D and three, which is shoot three and defend in the perimeter, they're so heavily valued in this NBA, in this day and age. They got him for a bargain. And when you think about their starting lineup, you've got Tony Parker, Danny Green, Kawhi Leonard, who I think in the next two or three years will be one of the best players in the NBA, maybe not from an offensive standpoint, but in terms of how much he contributes to the team. LaMarcus Aldridge and then Tim Duncan at center. It's arguably one of the best starting lineups in the league. Duncan's returning for his 19th season. He's still drinking from the fountain of youth. He's still playing at an incredibly high level considering his age, and I think a lot of it has to be attributed to the his work ethic, and also the front office and coaching of the San Antonio Spurs to recognize the amount of minutes that he really can handle on any given season, because you know he's going to be playing deep into the playoffs. Ginobili has indicated he's going to return. There's a lot of questions about how much is left in his tank, but he still has value to the team. I like to compare Manu Ginobili to kind of like your used car. He was like my Toyota Camry. It's not really worth anything to anybody else, but the value it is to you is immeasurable, it's intangible, and that's what kind of Manu Ginobili is to San Antonio Spurs, because he can really make an impact in games late in the season or in the playoffs. So it'll be interesting to see now that they've added David West to see who else they'll add to their roster, because aside from their starting lineup, the only guys they have under contract now are David West, Boris Diaw, and Patty Mills. So it's only eight guys. You need to add more of a roster out. So I would assume guys like Matt Bonner, some of these other guys will re-sign, but we've already seen Corey Joseph depart in free agency. Tiago Splitter signed with another team. Tiago Splitter traded another team. And then Aaron Baines, who was pretty crucial as a backup center for them, already signed with another team as well. So they obviously need to add more pieces, but when you have those eight guys, it really doesn't matter who else you add. You can add Brian Scalabrine, who'd come out of retirement, and you still would contend for the Western Conference title. Other winners, I would have to say the Bucks were a huge winner. They signed Greg Monroe, which kind of was indicative of where this league is moving. He turned down more money from both the Knicks and the Spurs to sign with the Bucks. Signed a 5-year, $70 million deal with an option for the fifth year, so he doesn't have to be, he's only under contract realistically for 4 years. And that really vaults Milwaukee in a position to compete in the Eastern Conference, which is already weak enough as it is, and some of the teams that were in playoff contention have gotten weaker. The Hawks, weaker because they weren't able to resign Damari Carroll. The Wizards, weaker because Paul Pierce departs for Los Angeles. So it probably makes them, realistically, the third or fourth best team in the Eastern Conference. I think the top five teams now in the East are Cleveland, Chicago, Milwaukee, Washington, and Atlanta, and then maybe Toronto's in the conversation there as well because they were able to get Damari Carroll. But it makes it for a scary starting lineup. There's nobody on that floor that is under 6'6" in their starting lineup. You've got Michael Carter-Williams, who's 6'6". You've got the Greek freak, Giannis Antetokounmpo, at the shooting guard position, who's 6'11". You have a 6'11 shooting guard. You're in pretty good shape. Chris Middleton at the three, who they also got for a great price in free agency, because you have to consider the cap's going to rise a considerable amount in 2 years, and these deals in 2017 will look like huge bargains. And then, so after the backcourt of Carter Williams, Middleton, and Antetokounmpo, you've got Greg Monroe and Jabari Parker as your two forward, or your forward and your center. I mean, that's a scary, scary starting lineup. And then you have a bunch of John Henson, Grievous Vasquez, Jared Dudley, and O.J. Mayo. That's nine players that could arguably start for a lot of teams in the NBA. That makes the Bucks pretty fearsome. And with their new rebranding effort, I would say the Bucks are top of my list for NBA League Pass next year to watch on a regular basis. Last team I think is a huge winner, just because everything kind of fell into their favor, has been Miami, both through the draft and free agency. They re-signed Wade. They re-signed Dragic. They drafted Justice Winslow, who we both talked about last week. Biggest steal in the draft.
Yeah,
we really like his athleticism, his physicality. Chris Bosh will hopefully be back and healthy from the health issue he was dealing with. And then Luol Deng, who's a serviceable player still, unexpectedly picked up his player option. It puts the Heat in a less than ideal situation from a cap perspective, but they still have a solid lineup, and they have Hassan Whiteside, who came on so huge for them last year, from not just a rebounding and block shot total, but will also prove that he can be a third scoring option. So those, I think, are the biggest winners from free agency.
Okay, and so then who did you think of as the losers from this?
Well, I think we both can agree that Los Angeles, the Lakers, and the Knicks both failed pretty miserably.
Basically, people who were going after Aldridge.
Yeah, anyone who was going after the big name after Aldridge and failed out. So, you know, you first have to mention the Trailblazers because they lost Wes Matthews. They lost LaMarcus Aldridge. They traded away Nick Batum. They didn't get a whole lot back for him. They got Gerald Henderson, which is a downgrade because he can't shoot. They got Mason Plumlee, who is a really good athletic defensive center, but he doesn't really bring anything offensively to the table. When you're looking at their starting lineup for next year, you've got Damian Lillard at the one, CJ McCollum at the two, who's serviceable but hasn't really proved to be an impact player in the league. Al Farouq Aminu, who you just signed away from Dallas for a pretty decent deal. I think he went for 4 years, $32 million, which is about the going rate for an average to less than average small forward now in the league. Then you've got Mason Plumlee and Noah Vonleh starting at the four. I mean, it just doesn't make – they went from being a team that could compete for the 4 or 5 seed in the West to a team that has no chance of making the playoffs in the West. And considering how much better those middle-of-the-road teams in the West are getting, I think it's a really bad time for them. And they just committed to a 5-year, $120 million deal with Damian Lillard. So they're investing a lot in him, but it's going to be about putting the right talent around him to build that franchise up. Another big loser, you have to look at the Clippers. They lost out on the DeAndre Jordan sweepstakes. And you kind of have to put part of the blame on Chris Paul. All the reports we're hearing now is that he kind of edged DeAndre Jordan out. And it was really up to them to decide between whether or not they wanted to re-sign Jordan and build around Jordan and Griffin and trade Chris Paul, or let Jordan walk in free agency. Because that, from everything I've been hearing, that relationship was beyond repairing. It's big loss for the Clippers considering he was their defensive anchor, and the team will have to rely more heavily on Blake Griffin, who is not the same kind of lengthy, springs in his leg defender that DeAndre Jordan is. I don't think that the loss of DeAndre Jordan pushes them out of the Western Conference playoff picture, but I think it puts them down in the 6-8 seed range. And as Chris Paul gets older, I think it pushes them really out of the contention position in the West. The title window was now for them, and it's kind of closed completely. I know they got Paul Pierce, and I know they got Lance Stephenson, and I think they really fully expected DeAndre Jordan to re-sign, but I think that relationship between those two was It was irreparable. It was beyond repair. So DeAndre Jordan signs with the Mavs. I think they still have a lot to do in work in free agency. I want to talk about them. I don't think they're a loser because they got both DeAndre Jordan and Wes Matthews. But they don't have a true starting point guard on that roster. I mean, you can't think you're going to contend in the West when you have point guards like, you know, Russell Westbrook and Tony Parker. You can't realistically think you're going to compete in the West with either Devin Harris or Raymond Felton. So I think it's important for them to try and address that need in free agency because they didn't in the draft. They drafted Justin Anderson out of Virginia. They can try and work out a deal for Ty Lawson, but they don't have many guys under contract, so that makes that difficult. So what I've heard is they might try and sign Jeremy Lin, who I think is a good stopgap for them in terms of where they want to be at. But their window is also closing as well because Dirk really realistically only has maybe one or two more years left in the tank. So I don't think the Mavericks are a loser, but I think they kind of fall into that category of we'll wait and see. But like I alluded to earlier, the biggest losers are the Lakers and the Knicks. I'll touch on the Knicks first because they tried to make some deals, and I think that these two teams might end up doing some work with each other later down the line, maybe, if Carmelo is interested in playing in Los Angeles. But the Knicks' only big signing so far this offseason has been Robin Lopez. But I wouldn't expect anybody in New York to think he's going to make any sort of impact in the win-loss column, because he's not. He's an energy guy. He can rebound well, but he's not really going to give you anything offensively. And they also traded away Tim Hardaway, who was one of their better offensive players for a draft pick, essentially, which became Jerry and Grant. So I think they've got some good pieces moving forward, but they don't have anyone that's going to fit into that window of winning now that could help Carmelo Anthony in the short term. Now, I think the biggest loser because of what they learned about themselves was the Los Angeles Lakers. They put all of their eggs in the LaMarcus Aldridge basket, much like the Knicks did. But you saw in this free agency period, players are putting less of a value on the strength of a market like a Los Angeles or a New York and putting a higher value on the right fit and the chance to win, which as Royals fans, we want to see our players down the road when they're making their signings opt for that.
See, I kind of feel like in sports in general, that's what you want to see. We're tired of seeing everyone go to the, just who's going to pay them the most money.
Right.
It's nice for people to look at, you know, where they fit and where they can win.
Yeah, and who and what the organizational values are.
Yeah.
And I think it's a mess in both of those two organizations. And I think you have an inherent problem when, and unfortunately, you know, rest in peace, when Jerry Buss died, I think the legacy of the Lakers, kind of, the winning attitude kind of died with it, and not because of anything particular, but I think when Jerry Buss was the owner and president of the team, he put a lot of trust in the Mitch Kupchak to do the right things and make the right moves for the organization. Now that Jeannie Buss is in charge and then her brother is in charge, I think Mitch Kupchak has a lot less control on personnel issues, and I think Jeannie Buss gets a little too... The Buss family, the Buss children, get too involved in the free agent process and the process of bringing people in. I mean, Jeannie Buss went on record and saying that anyone who doesn't want to sign with the Lakers and play with Kobe Bryant is probably a loser, and she went on record and said that. That already just rubbed people the wrong way. So the Lakers missed out on their first chance of a meeting with LaMarcus Aldridge because they didn't talk enough basketball, which you'd think in a meeting to sign a basketball player, you'd talk the appropriate amount of basketball, but they didn't. They filled some needs by signing Lou Williams, who has been the sixth man of the year before. They signed Brandon Bass, who's been the consummate professional in the NBA. He does anything the teams ask him to do. He'll play off the bench. He'll start. He'll rebound. He'll make the hustle plays. And then they traded for Roy Hibbert, but they did not bring a legitimate superstar, which the LaMarcus Aldridge signing would have done. And I don't even think Hibbert factors into their long-term plans, because I think he's just there so they can use him as a salary dump later in the year because they'll need to make the math work with a team with a disgruntled superstar at some point in the season, and that's where I think Carmelo Anthony comes into play. I don't really have a magic, you know, a crystal ball, and I can't predict the future, but I don't think Roy Hibbert ends the season in a Los Angeles Lakers uniform. I'm not going to say that he becomes a trade piece for Carmelo Anthony, but I think that you might see the Lakers leverage Hibbert's contract with the talent of a guy like Jordan Clarkson or Julius Randle to bring in a legitimate superstar. So those are my winners and losers in free agency. It sucks that the city of Los Angeles kind of had to lose out both teams. I think the people who were Lakers fans that flip-flopped over to the Clippers organization are feeling like maybe they didn't make the right call, but then again, the other options just isn't as great either. So it'll be interesting to see how the season breaks down. I think it's this is one of the most uncertain times in terms of where people will fall, especially in the Eastern Conference, because there's no real clear front runner aside from Cleveland and Chicago and Milwaukee. But the West is so stacked. I mean, you've got the Spurs have gotten better. The Thunder will get better because they'll add Kevin Durant, a healthy Kevin Durant, and a healthy Serge Ibaka back in the fold. The Warriors re-signed Draymond Green for a 5-year, $85 million a year deal. That's a great move by them. So they will be better, one with a championship under their belt. The Rockets have kind of stayed stagnant, but I think that at some point they might make a move to bring in like a Ty Lawson. The Jazz are getting better. The Grizzlies quietly got better. And the Mavericks have gotten better. And the Suns have gotten a little bit better, too. So it's going to be really interesting to see how this Western Conference plays out. I know I'm forgetting some teams, but it's going to be an exciting year in the NBA. And I think the interest level, like we talked about last week, just keeps on growing, mainly because you've got all these things happening and kind of the allure of the ease of mobility of these players in the NBA kind of makes it more interesting.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. So I think that pretty much wraps up everything we want to talk about this week. We've talked now for an hour. We hope. I think this is one of our best hours we've ever done, to be quite honest. I think we learn from being more prepared leads to a better show, more engaged show, and a more interesting show for you guys. So we hope you guys have another great week out there. We will be back hopefully on July 13th to bring you guys another episode of the Built on the Border podcast. We again encourage you guys to get involved with us on Twitter or by email. You can reach us at BorderKC on Twitter or at builtontheborder@gmail.com. We love to hear from our fans in terms of what they'd like to hear us talk more about, less about, and just make sure this show is engaging and interesting for everyone who's listening. So we will send you off today with one of our favorite songs right now this summer. It is Biscuits by our, I think we can agree it's a shared crush, Casey Musgraves. Great summer song, great country song. So we'll leave you guys with this as we exit the show. Have a great week out there. Hopefully the weather holds up and we don't have any more of these tornadoes and rain out here in the Midwest. Have a good one out there, guys. Peace. If you ain't got nothing nice to say, don't say nothing at all. Just hold your own road. Just do me and honey, you can just do you.